Hey, Link here. Thanks for joining me for episode 81, where I speak with Jared Arbair. In this episode, we talk about who they are, the upcoming 100 Acre Woods and how it got started, content creation and the state of the industry, wisdom learned from his experiences, words of reassurance to the Winnie the Pooh fans, what made them want to make games, life outside of gaming, their favorite recent trend, as well as some pretty funny lightning round questions. Before we get started, don't forget there are links in the episode description that you can follow to learn more about Jared as well as the podcast. Also, don't forget to like and share the episode, and without further ado, enjoy episode 81. Hi, welcome to the Red Tunic Podcast, a podcast where I look to rediscover what makes gaming fun and enjoyable by having positive conversations with those related to the industry. My name is Link, and today I'm joined by Jared Arbair, lead on Reload Magazine and currently working on 100 Acre Woods. Hi, Jared. How are you doing today?
Hi, I'm fantastic. It's early in the morning, and I'm thankful to be here.
Well, I'm also thankful that you're here, and I appreciate you taking time out of your early morning to be here, to speak with me. I really appreciate you just agreeing to do this. So thank you so much.
My absolutely my pleasure.
Now, Jared, before we get started, if you don't mind, can you tell me and anyone listening a little bit about yourself, current projects, basically whatever you feel people just absolutely need to know?
Yeah, I guess if somebody was like, hey, who's Jared? What does he do? I do a lot. I guess depends on the sphere that I would cross over in their life, right? Because to some people, I live stream and I just play games, and that's what some people will know me as. And then other people will know me through Reload Magazine, which I'm part of the leadership team there, along with a few other guys who are magazine leads. Reload Magazine being a retro and retro-inspired first-person shooter magazine. You can get it in print, but our goal is really community building and promoting projects that we think need eyes on it. Some other people might know me from my work with various publishers. I work really closely with 3D Realms. And in connection with that, I'm the host of Realms Deep, an annual gaming showcase where announcements, new titles, or updates are shown in kind of an entertaining format. There's a big Steam event that has to do with it. And then additionally, I'm also a developer on the creative director really behind 100 Acre Wood, which is a game I'm sure we'll talk a little about because it's something that is incredibly different than what people realize. And finally, we're hitting a point in that cycle where we want to talk about stuff and then show more stuff soon. But yeah, those are kind of, I probably forgot something in there. I do a lot of little bits and pieces here. But that's where people would know me from potentially.
So thank you for sharing that. And yeah, you know, I'm like me myself, I'm aware of the three streams. I think you, three streams. Sorry, I was double checking the notes that I wrote to make sure. Math is not a strong suit for me. So I'm aware of the three, and I hope other people are at least aware of maybe one or two. Because, you know, Reload Magazine's a really interesting project, and I really like the approach where you are aiming or hoping to put eyes on things that you guys feel is, I don't want to say deserving, because that almost sounds elitist, or not elitist, sorry. I don't know the right word, but it feels dirty to say deserving. But like, for me, it feels dirty to say deserving. But like, just that you feel more people should be aware of. I think that's a good approach, because there's a lot of stuff that comes out, and there's a lot of good stuff that comes out that just falls by the wayside, unfortunately. And you see those projects being worked on, and yeah, like, you're just in amazement of what kind of crazy stuff is being done with them, or new things or cool things. And it's not getting the attention you feel it deserves, it should have, right?
So yeah, like, it's actually one of the reasons I think I probably kind of got into bed with these magazines back when, like, I was doing the full-time streaming thing for a while, and that was like my top priority. And then I remember a specific event. I don't always remember this, but when I do remember it, I want to mention it. I forget the game, but I remember seeing an indie developer who'd worked on a game for like 3 years, and it was an okay game. It was fine. There was it was completely fine, and they made like $500 on it. And I remember like there was like this emotional connection I felt when I saw this tweet. It wasn't a person I followed. It just, the algorithm sent it to me. And I remember, I mean, for lack of a better word, I remember like feeling a sense of grief for this person because they'd invested an insane amount of time into this project and they didn't get any eyes on it. And there's a lot of reasons, you know, marketing reasons, saturation reasons, visual elements in the game, and maybe why the little marketing they did didn't impact people. And I remember being like, I don't like this. This feels bad to know it exists. And so as I kind of connected to these communities, I kind of went, well, maybe there's something I can assist in this. Maybe there's a little thing I can do here or there. Maybe I can maybe I can be a pebble in one person's life that causes an avalanche later, and do my part in that. And so yeah, it's crazy because I feel dirty about the word deserving as well. I probably never use it. But I think about that, and it just is, it's one of those things where it's like, okay, like there are projects that will be something somebody enjoys, and if the right person enjoys it, then another person might enjoy it, another person, and so Reload and really anytime I engage with indie developers, indie publishers, this includes like one of the reasons we do Realms Deep. Like all of these things are like kind of in connection as far as like their goals and attitudes, is kind of the lifting up of indie developers, because we have an opportunity and creating opportunities to do that so that those people don't end up in that situation. Some people are still going to end up in that situation. It's going to be horrible, but I would really like to at least have less people land in that spot.
And, you know, I think that's a great mentality approach to go with. And I realized as you were talking, as like, you know, things were being explained, I think you probably have, saying it out loud, you probably have like the same hookup with deserving, or in the moment you might. However, I think I realized I think I took deserving in a different light, in the sense of that they deserve the attention. They deserve to be seen, not that, and this is entirely on me. Like, I'm not saying this is how you felt. I want to be clear. This is how I interpret it, how I would, if I were to say it, this is how it would work out in my mind, because my mind's really weird. But like, I understand, I think a little better that the term deserving is because they put all that work in. When you do that, when you put yourself out there, you deserve to be seen, like at that person on that project, right? It's not so much, and again, this is on my interpretation.
No, that makes sense. That does make sense. Yeah. Yeah. I'm on board with you on that angle. Yes, absolutely.
Yeah. So it's not so much, how I interpret as, you know, there's arbiters that deserve or decide who gets who's deserving, but it's more that, you know, they had a passion project that they worked on really long. It's turned out great, and no one saw it, and that person deserves to have it seen, right? Just in the same way.
Yeah,
they should.
That people... there should be something there, and there should be people who kind of champion those causes.
Yes.
Like, and that is it's funny because I think that has been like the path that I have kind of inadvertently walked between all of my projects and all of the things I get to be involved in is, yeah, you're right. It is that thing where there's a compassionate pull on my heart when I see somebody who's worked hard on something and I go, oh man, well, I would really like this person to get some eyes. And so, yeah, that thread kind of like intertwines between everything that I get to touch.
And, you know, like I said, I feel that's great because, you know, in a lot of ways you're seeing other creators. I'll use Dunkey as an example, just because I think his is one of the bigger, more known ones right now, where he went from, you know, his climb to where he is in YouTube,
to running game jams, to having a small studio now where he's publishing or helping create or what have you. I think that is a fantastic trajectory.
Because... Oh yeah, Dunkey. I'm glad that exists, because Dunkey has the financial backing, and as he started Big Mode, that's a huge deal, because that's part of the challenge is you have a lot of, there's this trend right now, right, of micro publishers, and generally if you hear micro publisher, it a lot of the time means that hey, we don't have the funding, but we have people who are passionate to help you. But you have the case where games cost money, and so Dunkey has done a good thing because Dunkey happens to have money. And so, yeah, I think that is one of the wonderful things that is happening. Generally a fan of Dunkey, there's a few things I could take or leave, but generally as a fan of him and what he's doing, big props and high fives to him for Big Mode.
Yeah, and and that I think the way he's doing, I think is. I've seen other creators aiming to do something similar. And it sounds like, you guys in the sense of Reload Magazine or what have you, but you on a personal level, it sounds like that's maybe not where you hope to be, because I imagine that's a lot of work. And if you already have a bunch of balls in the air that you're juggling, yes. But it sounds like you're kind of moving in that direction as well. And, for me personally as well, I'd like to one day hopefully be in that direction as well. So I can understand and can use this one again. I can empathetically feel and connect to the cause that you have. For people that are wondering why I use again, before we were starting the ramp up, I used that one for something entirely different. But anyway, but yes, I know where you're coming from, and I can connect to that. And I hope others can as well, just because, as I realized, it's the people, when you have passion projects, you should be seen, you should be recognized. And when you make a good product, it sucks when no one gets to experience that product.
Yes.
Because, you put your heart and soul into it. And, even if it's a short project, it should still be seen, right?
Mm-hmm. Yep. Yeah. And that's kind of the goal of a lot of these things that we touch.
So, Jared, I do want to ask this one because you said we'll probably talk about, let's definitely talk about 100 Acre Woods. And now I don't know if this is your first foray into developing or making games or what have you. And we'll walk towards it, I guess, in the event of there's things before it. But how did you get into developing and making games?
So this is there is a lot of stuff before it, and I'll try to minimize the turns. But 100 Acre Wood is an interesting project because I didn't intend to do it. It wasn't a thing I was going to work on. It was something that I handed off to somebody a while back. And so you ask, I guess this is a good place to start. You ask if this is my first kind of foray into that environment, and the half answer is yes, and the half answer is no. Over the past several years, as I've kind of leaned away from the idea of pursuing primarily content creation, and I generally despise that term because there's connections and implications with it, and I never fit the mold. I never fit the content creator mold. I didn't want to play the game, I didn't want to play the social games that come with it, and the dramatic games that are generally required to force growth. I didn't enjoy that life, but I do enjoy community building and all the things that are connected with that. And so, and I was making enough of a living just doing that, that I could have kept doing it. But as I started to grow and developers started to kind of, I started to become, there was this major change in my attitude. I became rather than, so when you're a content creator, okay, I'm on path now. I got it. When you're a content creator, there's this social thing that you do for self gain generally, where you connect to a publisher or developer, and they follow you, and it increases your personal renown, and you begin to grow and become somebody. And so you're kind of gathering up people like Pokemon, right? This guy follows me. I interact with this guy, and it boosts you up, and you feel good about it. I really disliked that a lot. The second I started getting those emotional bubbles of oh, this developer's following me and this person interacts with me often, it felt dirty. And so I kind of had a course correction. And this is all related to the game. I had a major course correction where I went, you know what? Let's not do this. Let's become legitimate fans of these people instead of making this about me. I'm just going to kind of set course to enjoy what people do and the things people make in a sincere way, and put some effort into sincerely lifting other people up and enjoying their projects and becoming a fan. And so I kind of placed my feet on the ground, and that's the attitude I had moving forward. And that changed the way that I interact with people a lot. Rather than sitting on my golden throne, playing games, evaluating them, saying bad things about them because I feel superior, I started to have these people around, these people who I was just legitimately a fan of, in chat or interacting, and I started to realize that because I liked them and because I was a fan of them, I wanted to be careful in the way I spoke about their products and their games. And so my evaluation went from this is bad to being very careful and to navigate meaningful things. And so as people would send me things to play publicly, I just kind of changed the way I talked about them. And that led to a bunch of paid opportunities with publishers and developers, generally with indie developers. I wasn't charging for services, but with publishers I did, where I kind of created this job, right? And I would write these reports that I called general customer or general player perception reports. How a normal human being is going to see your game. Because one of the challenges that happens when you're developing a game is you're in the development cave so long, you can't see the game. You just see the wall in front of you. And so I would spend a bunch of time in the beginning of titles, and I would say, hey, this is what a normal person is going to see. This is what a normal person is going to understand. I understand your game is great, but this gun is so ugly, you have to change it because people are going to laugh at this visual element. They will not see the incredible thing you've done. And so I started working with a bunch of indie developers, and generally I'm careful about mentioning ones I've worked on, because if they don't credit me directly, like the deal was, it's like you pay me and I don't care, or I'm doing this. But if you see me in special thanks or something, that's generally what I've done for a project is a perception report. And so I became very good at those, where we would change the beginning of games, and then those games would, the reception of the intro of those games would be significantly better than it would have been. And so it kind of became almost a drive-by production role that within kind of back channels, developers began knowing me for. And I didn't wave a flag and say, hey, guys, I'm doing this. It was just word of mouth. Hey, go talk to Jared. He'll handle this for you. And so I got a lot of experience over the course of the past several years in creative direction and production, but working within other people's universes and the things that they were creating. So getting on board with their vision and then kind of augmenting that and helping them understand what it was going to be. And so that's where my development skills began. But 100 Acre Wood. So around the time, this is funny, because it's like when we with 100 Acre Wood, like there's a lot of assumptions about what the game is, like a cash grab, this thing, that thing. And oh my gosh, I love what it's becoming. I love what it is, and I wouldn't have thought that I would love what it's becoming. But I handed it off to a friend like around the time that Winnie the Pooh became public domain. There's a bunch of legal laws and rules and stuff you got to follow. And so I handed off this idea and I said, hey, if you want to make some money, go ahead. Here's a concept. Your developer, do this. And he said, I'm going to put this in my pocket. And 6 months later, he approached me and he was like, you know what? I think I have time for this, but I don't want to do it alone. I want to do it with you. And at that point in my life, I didn't have hands-on experience as far as in-engine. And so I agreed. We sat with each other a lot, and it became exceedingly inconvenient for me to micromanage a developer. And so in response to that, I was like, screw it, I'm just going to learn what I'm doing. And so I began to spend a lot more time on weekends in Unreal Engine and learning and gaining the necessary skills to at least partake in a development process in a more meaningful way rather than sitting in my armchair and directing. And so, yeah, 100 Acre Wood is, it's not my first experience in industry, but it's the first time that that I've ever grabbed the reins and been like, okay, I'm working hard on this myself. This is mine.
So thank you for sharing that path, that, you know, the A to B to C. That's really interesting to hear that, you know, you went from, well, if the whole idea of content creation and not wanting to really play that version of the game, right? Because it's anyone that knows about any facet of content creation, quote unquote. Because you're right, I do agree that that is kind of like a weird, dirty word if you are not inclined to do a lot of what you have to do to mm-hmm. do certain things. You know, for example, like, I don't know if you've seen it recently, but ProZD put out, or Sung Wong, he put out a video where he was basically like, hey, I don't think my YouTube is going to exist as it exists because of, he doesn't play the game, right? And, yeah. There's other YouTubers that have, have definitely...
There's a major shift across the board right now where a lot of people are tired of being content mills. I love seeing that. It's so encouraging to see major, like well-known individuals, kind of put their hand up and be like, "Yeah, I think I'm done with this," and to begin to create some, like the ones that are staying on board are wanting to create meaningful things. And I think that's part of the shift that I felt early on is looking at it being like these things I have to do that make this thing. I don't want to make that thing, but I'm told that that's the process. And I want to be involved in real things. I want to make something meaningful with my life. And these are the skills I have. So how can I do this? And yes, to see them changing those things it's been a fantastic shift in the industry.
Yeah, exactly. And you know where I was getting to with that is like I understand where you're coming from, and it's not a. It seems to, like you said, it's a much bigger thing, which is very nice to see because. The system is kind of broken in how it works. And yeah, it definitely does need to change in that regard. And, you know, one of the other things I liked is how your approach to not wanting to, I'm going to use publicly because I can empathetically relate to this. But publicly, I can definitely understand not wanting to trash talk a game, right? It's like, and I'll you know, in all honesty, for me privately, I will say, I don't want to say I'm going to say like toxic and visceral things. I'm just a little more emotive about how I describe things because like I'm not worried about the constraints of how my words will be perceived because I share them with people that I know personally and they understand the language that I use and what the implications and meanings behind my words are. Right.
Yeah.
I'm going to assume that might be kind of in line with you as well, because, you know, you can say something to like your partner or your best friend and they know that it's a flare of hyperbole, or they know that it's coming from a point of a lot of contention in you. However, the publisher or like the general public or what have you might not quite know the nuance of the words that you use. So I very much respect the idea of trying to limit your language to be more positive in nature, because like it does no good when you are trying to share the nuance of something and the words you're using create conflict or confusion. And I like the idea that you you've created a system, a quote unquote system, because I don't know if it's the right word for yourself, where when publishers or devs reach out to you and the interaction or the exchange or what have you is about trying to say it in a positive way. So that way other developers or not developers, other people, players see it in a positive way. And like when I talk about games with people as well, that's typically the same place that I put myself is as like an average gamer. And like, I don't, you know, Mario is Mario, right? Like, you know, I've been playing Mario literally my entire life. However, if I'm going to have a complaint about Mario, it's still going to be from the point of, you know, I can do this. However, I have 30 plus years of experience doing the run and the jump, right?
Yeah.
But like other people might not be able to handle this because for like their whatever reason they have, right? It doesn't matter. And like, I like the approach that you're taking because it's a very similar one that I take publicly and privately, but you know, privately has far more nuance to it, as I'm sure yours does as well.
Well, I think I've had this major shift in terminology, and yes, you're right. But very few games are bad. But we use that word really regularly. But very few games are actually bad. And so in public, people say things like, "Oh, this game, oh, it's so bad. I hate this game." Right. And so, and then you go, "Do you really?" And they go, "Oh no, I don't." And you go, "Okay, well, what do you mean by that's bad?" And I think a key moment for me is I watched a guy play Dark Souls 3 and he was 20 hours in and he started talking about how the game is bad. And I was like, to describe Dark Souls 3 as bad is that's kind of hard to actually do. It's not bad. You might have a bad response to it. There might be several issues. It could be accessibility. It could be a skill issue. It could be maybe you had something bad for lunch and you're just not feeling into it, right? But very few games are actually bad. But we use the term bad to mean less than 7. But a 7 out of 10 is still pretty good. If fun is not a light switch, it's a fader, right? Like there are different degrees of fun, and if I'm having 3 fun, I'm still having 3 fun. I'm not having 0 fun. And so so the idea is, yeah, as in public, I noticed I had embraced bombastic terminology. Which is a very popular thing to do. It's a very normal thing to do. I actually think that, I mean, I have big views on it that YouTube and those cultures in general have really kind of poisoned a lot of gamers' experiences because they stop having fun and look for bad and they really enjoy saying things are bad. And as I kind of came to this realization that very few games are actually bad, I kind of just wanted to shift my terminology away from that. And again, the social pressure of having developers in my chat, rooms early on, that made me go, okay, I'd better be more specific. Because instead of saying this is bad, I would say, hey, this thing specifically, I'm not meshing with this right, and here's why I'm not. This is giving me an experience that doesn't feel good. And so rather than like taking that moment and allowing it to represent the entire experience I'm having, I'm able to lock that down and to be like, this part does not feel good. This part feels bad. And then recognizing, the current trend in industry, and kind of recognizing the weakness of players in that most people, when they see that bad thing, will allow that bad thing to flavor the rest of their experience. And so again, as I work and have these projects with people, in general, it was operating from that understanding. Like I used an example of a gun. I played this retro first person shooter that was awesome, but the artwork on the gun that was in your face was just like horrible. It felt bad to look at, and it made it feel cheap. And I looked at that and talking to the developer, I was like, here's the deal. Is when I load this up, this is what I see. This is what a normal person is going to see. This is what I would be defending the game from a live chat room. They would all be saying, look at this thing, look at this thing. And they can't see the stuff behind it. They can't see that this experience is actually fun if you ignore that. And so recognizing the weakness of the players and kind of the general social structures attached to that and the habits that people have from watching like highly evaluatory YouTubers and streamers, we need to recognize that that's going to happen and we need to change that so they can engage. So minimal effort, like maximum effect. Let's change this thing so that that doesn't happen. And you know, that stems from realizing that there's very few bad games. There's just sometimes bad elements.
Yeah, exactly. And, you know, I agree completely with everything that you're saying. And as someone that at first started this podcast because I was slipping into that form of toxicity, and I need to be very explicit on that form of toxicity because, you know, the other toxicity is like sending death threats to developers. That yes. ain't cool. Calm your calm down, everyone, just stop. But like I had a very well, also for me, I always hit if there was a bug in a game, I was gonna hit it. I don't know what I was cursed with, but I will hit the worst bugs, the dumbest bugs. I will hit all the bugs. And that really flavored my how I enjoyed the game as a whole. And it blinded me because, you know, I'm hitting every damn bug that could exist. And, you know, I was very susceptible to that toxicity of being poisoned by it. And
yeah,
so yeah, I 100% know where you're coming from. I think it's a great approach because it's also the same kind of approach that I have had, or the shift that I have also had in my life. Because yeah, games aren't bad. There's bad elements, and you can't let a bad element make the game bad, right?
Yeah,
like
you could ask me if you asked me what a bad game was right now, I would have trouble actually identifying what a bad game is because you have the classics, right? People would be like, oh, Daikatana is a bad game. And then you look at it and you go, not really. No, it's not. It's got some stuff in the way that's going to stop you from engaging with an actual well-designed game in the background. And if you can identify those things, you can actually see what was going on. Like I sure it's a buggy mess. I played through the last official patch because I wanted to kind of have the final experience, not the fan patch. Right. And so point is I don't even think that game's bad. I think it's got some bad stuff and it has some major issues and mechanical issues. And but I would have trouble identifying a bad game like with this definition and understanding. I could definitely identify bad elements, but a bad game, I just don't think I don't know which ones exist at this point anymore when seen through those eyes.
Exactly. And again, like I said, I know exactly where you're coming from. I think it's a great approach, and not to, you know, not to beat too much of a dead horse and, you know, not focus on bad elements of games. And this is a horrible segue. How are you taking everything that you've learned into 100 Acre Woods?
And
do you have
well.
Wisdom to share about how
so
to not
well.
Take
that? Well, and this is the thing that was the frustration, as I was saying, like this is why I learned to work in Unreal Engine, right? Is sitting there with a developer, somebody who is making a level, and at that point in my life, I'm like, I could work pen and paper, I could design, I just didn't have the technical skills, right? Like, so I would draw a thing out, and I'd be like, this is what we're doing, make it happen, and he'd be like, this is great, this is really really good, and then he'd go, and I'd sit there with him, and I would see things that would bother me. And I'd be like, this hill over here is providing an experience where the player is not going to see where they need to be, see what they need to do. They're going to get lost and distracted by this thing here. Without a doubt, that we are creating an experience that is going to make them feel bad. And so watching that, I was like, I just need to get in. I just have to get in there and do this. And so now it's one of those things where taking these things, then these attitudes and these ideas that I've been practicing with other people and putting and actually hands-on in my game, is it's extremely rewarding and extremely satisfying. Especially when my drive and my passion in this game, it always feels so funny. I like because this is a Winnie the Pooh thing, right? But the like we are approaching this from a perspective, people maybe, and we're not worried about like correcting disinformation, because like the idea is make the game as it gets closer, market appropriately, and don't worry about like correcting people's understanding now, just show them something special when it's time. But the idea of micro detailing to me matters a lot, because my favorite games of all time and the thing that makes me want to make games are games that tell environmental story in meaningful ways. Games like Bloodborne, where there's four statues over here and one of them is different. Why is that statue different? It actually has a narrative reason why it is. And somebody can walk past that and not ever notice, and that's okay, because they get their own special experience by walking past and not noticing. But the guy who looks also gets a special experience and understands that there's a narrative being told by his environment. And by words when words are appropriate. And so as I'm making this game and getting to do these things and direct the player's attention, it's such a satisfying process because we have this incredible story that we've written. I use Bloodborne as an example, right? Like Bloodborne, a lot of people play through Bloodborne and just think it's about werewolves and they get confused at the end. They don't realize it's a science fiction story. like, and that person has a very special experience. They have even though they only did 30% of the game, they have 100% of an experience. And their experience is special. They played through a werewolf game and it confused them, and they liked it because they had a full experience with 30% of the game. And so the idea that I love, and from all the games and stories that have pushed me towards the type of game that we're making, is to go, I want to do that. I want to make a game that can be interacted with to the depth that a player desires themselves. So if a person is intellectually minded in their behaviors and they look and they notice, then they will have a different type of satisfaction. But also acknowledging that that John, who just got home from work and just wants to play a scary game, he doesn't want to engage with that stuff. I want to cater to him as well. I want to make a multi-leveled personal narrative for people, right? And so that has been our development goal and process as we've done this. And it's a really satisfying thing to do, especially when I have a team working with me, two of my very close friends. We recently had a shift in team members. One of the original guy had some health issues and that he really needed to prioritize that, and so he has gone away to deal with that and left the project. And so I have my friend Greg, and I haven't really announced it yet. We're announcing this week, but my good friend Sheridan Roberts has joined us, kind of in asset creation. He's got some other skills that apply, but he's passionate and just meshes well with the team. And so he is. We have a lot of placeholder assets right now. And so bringing on a member of the team to address placeholder assets directly is nice. So he gets to do that. I have a gameplay programmer who gets to focus on vibe and feel. And then I just get to craft this beautiful world and this beautiful narrative attached to the world and make it consistent consistent with the source material, and yet simultaneously work something in that is surprising and engaging in a more meaningful way. And again, like my primary influences in writing style really stem from, if we're talking games, we're talking about like Souls games and maybe games like Alan Wake, where you can engage to the degree that you want. But additionally, like my major influence, this is going to sound fake, my major influences in writing and the way you reveal things to players stem a lot from kind of the overarching Warhammer 40K and fantasy universe, where you have this massive narrative, and if you gather information from multiple places, you understand more. You can see things that somebody doesn't see when they just read a book. And I have I've sat down and read over 300 Warhammer books. I had a couple years of unemployment, and so I just sat in a Starbucks and I read a book a day. I literally at least 300 Warhammer books during those time periods. And so the concept of large scale narrative that is not shared with a person who's engaging on one level but can be seen on another level is such an appealing thing to me, because that is where I get my joy. Like one of the questions you asked me before the show is the idea of like what made me want to make games. And it's not games that make me want to make games. It's the satisfaction that you get from personally unlocking narrative. When you go, oh, I understand that, where a player is directed to a place where they can open up a box in their mind and go, and the pieces click and they go, oh, okay, I figured that out. And in part, yes, they figured it out, but they were also led there. They just need to be skillfully led. And so, yeah, with 100 Acre Wood, we're approaching this thing that initially started as kind of, let's just make a stupid meme game, to Well, I don't want to make a stupid meme game. Like, I want to make something that is narratively impactful and fun. And yeah, it's funny because you could drop the poo stuff at this point, and the game will narratively exist in a very strong sense. And then we're like, well, why don't we do that? And it's like, well, because this actually enhances it. And like the Winnie the Pooh children's story thing, like, actually enhances what's going on. And we can't wait until that statement makes sense to people, because currently it might not make sense, but in the end it will to some people. And other people are just going to engage with it as a stupid meme game because that's what they want to do, and that's awesome. I more power to those people. I think that's great.
So, you know, thank you for that. You said a lot of different things. You actually branched into a lot of the questions that I usually try and bring up and jump off from. So I'm going to try and focus this one before we move on and maybe focus on some other things. I don't know why I had such a weird speaking pattern for that. So the one question I have, and this isn't meant to be a deep question, I'm just giving you that a heads up now that I don't have expectations of a you know, that this is a big drawn out what have you. However, what do you say to the people like me that, you know, I'm 36, so I, you know, Winnie the Pooh existed well before me. The Disney version of Winnie the Pooh existed well before me, I think like the 70s, the 60s, something like that. But for me, Winnie the Pooh existed as a VHS bootleg tape. I don't know. I think it came from my cousin with a dinosaur drawn on it. I don't know why there was a dinosaur drawn on it, but that was my Winnie the Pooh. I ran that tape into the ground until Disney did their, like, From the Vaults or their Black Diamond, whatever the hell they called their stuff. But that was my Winnie the Pooh. So what do you say to people like me that, you know, with the VHS tape, with the little dinosaur on it, what do you say to us where we're expecting, you know, our version or our memories of Winnie the Pooh, and this is what you're throwing at us?
So I have this goal that is front and center, to have a high degree of faithfulness to the source material. And a lot of that comes from familiarity with A.A. Milne's book. But for context for people, like, we're not, like, Disney stuff is still copywritten, but A.A. Milne's original book is not. And that's the thing that's public domain. And that is a very special book to a lot of people. It's like a core memory to some people. Or if it's not, they think it's something that's been more impactful in their life. We still want to connect and be like, this, we respect what this is. This is because it's a special book. It's well written. It's actually kind of a piece of world history for, like, it really is. Like, I mean, it's huge, right? And so rather than taking this and grabbing it and making it our own thing, we want to have these touch points where you go, oh, this is a reference to this event. These are. This is in part elements of a story that I'm familiar with. And so our goal is to, again, tell this multi-story narrative. And man, there's just one piece of the story that makes this all make sense. That is like a big reveal that's going to be at the end for those who want it. And so I can't mention it, but like the promise is that respecting the source material is really important to me. Additionally, taking that source material and making it something special, and for people who don't know, like, thematically, our game is a cosmic horror game, and cosmic horror at heart is always kind of sci-fi adjacent, not necessarily sci-fi like laser guns and spaceships flying around, but generally like greater universe, horrible things happening, mankind very small and scared and worthless and helpless, and so we have like a love for the source material to the point where all of our written narrative elements come from the book. And that's been a huge thing for me. There's the book is huge, so there's lots of stuff to work with. But so when we're talking about when we're talking about a flooded area and something that takes place within the game, there's a chapter where part of the wood floods, and we take a lot of those contexts or a lot of those quotes, and we embrace the ones that are memorable. We twist the context a bit, but not to the point where it's unrecognizable. And so our goal is to have these touch points where things make sense to people who are familiar with it. And if they're not familiar with it, it's not dependent on those things. And I think probably the best example, and not to get comparative, but the way like American McGee's Alice handles Alice in Wonderland, there is a clear respect and passion for the source material, but it's also twisted to the point where it is appealing to people who don't care and appealing to people who do care. And so we've taken that approach, and a lot of that is almost there's a mental anguish when you're writing and working around a thing to fit it into that box in a way that that still feels generally palatable. And I think a lot of that, again, I'm very thankful for my experience in industry where palatability matters to me. But also taking something and doing something special and original is really important. So I think that kind of answers the question the way that we're approaching that in our goal.
Yeah, so thank you. That's, you know, yes, you very much answered that one. I'm not gonna lie, I was more expecting going with the joke approach, but you know, you very much took that and ran with it well beyond what, you know, my expectations were gonna be. But thank you, because that is an interesting approach to actually use the original book and create plot points or what have you surrounding mm-hmm. that, which is I personally did not have any reservations about the game that you are making. In the same way that I have no reservations about anyone else's games or largely the projects that I've seen surrounding the public domaining of Winnie the Pooh. Because, you know, I would hope others would recognize that it's its own thing, what it's coming from, where their inspirations are. Some of them, like you touched on, you know, haha, funny meme thing, but other ones are obviously not going that route. And it's really interesting to hear that you guys are taking such a serious, I don't know if that's the right word, or what have you, inspiration from the source. And I think that makes it better because, you know, for anyone that says haha funny meme game, it doesn't sound like that's what it's going to be. Well, there might be elements, or that might be how some people take it. It's good to know that, you know, this is not just a thing that you're doing just because you're doing it as Winnie the Pooh, you know?
Yeah, well, and it started as that, and then we became uncomfortable with making something mediocre. I think that's really the core of it is like, and it's such a shame. So, I mean, a side note, we had to announce earlier than we intended because, and I mentioned this in a podcast the other day, but we weren't supposed to announce the game yet. Unfortunately, I'm very careful about the way I talk about other people's projects. There was a project that got announced and nobody noticed, that very clearly fell into the money grab kind of category, and the effort put into it was very minimal, and if you look at the history of this particular developer, that's kind of a thing he does, is he just kind of kicks things out with asset flips. Winnie the Pooh wasn't Winnie the Pooh at all. He was literally a fat zombie with yellow skin, and you look at it and you're like, this is like there's no problem. You can use assets to other, like, you can use purchase assets in games. I think that's a great thing. A great tool for a lot of people, but there's a line that gets crossed where it becomes evident that the goal is to be first to the party and to kick something out. And so somebody was first to the party while we were developing this game. And so I think people weren't even supposed to know about the game until like really recently, but we had to announce very early because this game got announced, and we kind of had this emergency meeting, right, where we were like, okay, and this is when it was just me and one other guy. We were like, well, we have to announce, so how are we going to do it? Because we don't want this guy to get the coverage, because the thing he's making is clearly something that that will poison what we're doing, because then people are going to associate us with that. We're going to be the second one. And so we kicked out an announcement trailer, and we had to use a bunch of placeholder assets, like way too many, way more than we wanted to. And we're still like emotionally reeling from having to do an early announcement. But we did not want that game to catch people's eyes before ours. We wanted to be first to the party because we want to make something special. But we're taking longer to get there because we are making something. We were making something with a degree of passion and effort that requires more work. And so yeah, it's one of those things where we really didn't even want to announce yet. It was not even a goal of ours. And so we're in a revamp stage right now, like I said, where everything's getting replaced and remade. And the next time anybody sees our game at all, it's not going to look anything the same. We just unfortunately had to announce early. And again, that's because the idea of like haha funny meme game was coming out, and we didn't want that to be the representation that this character and universe was going to get. We wanted to be the ones, and fortunately, when as we did announce, we got the coverage from IGN and PC Gamer and all those other things, and so it's kind of mean, but I don't mind it too much because of the history of this particular developer. We kind of just buried him very quickly. Like 2 weeks after his announcement, we did ours. And I'm not particularly upset about that just because the standard practice of this guy is not exactly honorable and artistic. He just kind of does that stuff. So that's why people know about our game already when they shouldn't have.
So, you know, fair enough. Understandable in you know, a lot of ways. So thank you for that. Now, I'm going to shift it a little.
Yeah.
Because I am curious about this. You know, you touched on bits of this, and I'm curious, what was the game that made you want to get into developing games? And I apologize if you did cover that. I mm-hmm. missed it and didn't make my note on that. So I apologize if you've already said it.
It's funny. Actually, I don't mind revisiting this a little bit because I brushed past it. I don't think games made me want to make games. I think stories did. And I think that games are the best way to tell a story. Like I'm firm on that. Books are great; they're amazing. And so my time spending reading a lot of large scale narratives made me want to tell stories. But I didn't want to write a book. And then as over the last several years, as games have been engaging with narrative in different ways because they're able to, I've realized that there's this concept of personal narrative that is so attractive to me and has drawn me to want to work in games. And that idea is like when I play Bloodborne, I play through different than you. I have a different experience. I notice things different that give me suspicions about a solid factual narrative behind the game that maybe somebody else doesn't get. And I'm having an experience that is unique. You can't have that with a book because a book tells you everything unless you're talking large scale narrative. Games like Alan Wake. I played through the first Alan Wake in one sitting. It took me 22 hours. I was all sort of crazy at the end of it. It is one of the most amazing experiences I've had in receiving a story in my life, because I got to the end. I went from a mysterious world to realizing that it's a cosmic horror story, and it's amazing. And having that experience of getting to have a personal narrative that I get to engage with on the depth that I desire as a player is so attractive to me. Immersive sims do this, right? Like I love M-Sims. But my experience with an immersive sim, I generally play through one time. I know there's people who 100% games. I used to do that, and then I 100%ed the entire Ezio trilogy, and I never want 100% a game again, ever in my life. I'm done. Way too much busy work. And so now when I play through a game, I like to do it one time generally, rarely two times, But as I play through immersive sims, my experience is singular. I have a different experience. When I play through Arx Vitalis, there are three or four ways to get into the King's Chamber. My story that I experience is different than yours. And I love that about the potential of games. Not every game does that. A lot of games do. But that's what makes me want to work in industry. That's what made me want to work in industry and made it something that I consider worth putting effort in, is the ability to create stories, personal narrative, even though people might not identify it as that, their own unique bespoke story of the experience they had. And so, yeah, with our game, again, like that is a goal, is there's a lot of stuff that you may or may not see. And if you don't see it, that's fine. You're creating your own personal narrative. If you're confused at the end, that's totally fine. I think that's great. If you understand more, I think that's beautiful. I think that's wonderful. I want to be engaged with the ability. I want to engage with the ability to create personal narrative. And I think video games are the best way to do that.
So thank you. And I think that's a very interesting approach because, and I don't mean this in a negative way, so I'm trying to think of the best way to say all of this. Because, you know, I've spoken to a good chunk of people at this point, and, you know, I don't recall there being anyone who's taken the approach of, well, it wasn't a game. I've spoken to people where it was many games or it was a genre or what have you, but I don't think I've spoken to anyone where the quote-unquote game, I'm doing air quotes here, was what, like, you know, that got them into wanting to do this was actually the story element from not games, you know? And I think that's really interesting because it further highlights that the industry, by and large, is not just gamers. You know, I've spoken to some people where they were not really gamers until they started making games, which is perfectly fine, you know, for anyone that's listening. Like, you don't have to, you know, you don't have to be doing what you're doing all the time or whatnot, right? So I think that's really interesting that the game or the thing that made you want to get into games was writing a story or telling a story that could be interpreted and experienced however the actor,
right? Yeah.
The actor is getting to do it. It's kind of like improv where I'm a much more serious version of improv, I'm presuming, in this scenario. But it's kind of like improv where the experience that you have is not going to be the same because rarely are you going to play the game the same every single time. You know, like if, well, unless you're a speedrunner, at that point you are striving the game to be played the same every single time, right? You know, I have 5 seconds and that guy's going to walk past that hallway in 5 seconds. I got to, you know, but you know, by and large, you know, that's an interesting approach to want to be focused more on creating a story that is going to allow people to experience and digest differently and not, you know, and be able to share it with someone that, you know, has not had the same experience. Kind of like when you ask someone about Dwarf Fortress or talk about Dwarf Fortress with someone, never is that game the same. Never will you talk to someone with Dwarf Fortress and have the same story. You'll have the same elements, you know. Yeah, the clowns, the circus showed up and the clowns, you know, poured out. Like, yeah, that's a common theme. For anyone that doesn't know what that means, for Dwarf Fortress, the circus is when you delve too deep and the clowns are demons. you know, that's always going to happen, right? Or what have you. But the surrounding events for it are never going to be the same. And I think that's a very interesting approach to making games or to wanting to make games. So thank you for sharing that. I think that's going to be an interesting, knowing that, that is going to be an interesting way to approach playing the game, right?
Yeah, and it's one of those things where, like, we have that as like a core value, but additionally, like in our title, like we have shared core values that do recognize that people want to have fun and they want to not, like there are people who want to just, sometimes it's fun to move around in a game. Like, you'll play those games where it's just fun to move around on a flat surface and you instantly identify, hey, wait a second, this is fun. Like, that's, and so So you have this thing where it's like narrative experience is important, but equally important to us is the idea of how do I feel as I'm playing this? Do I feel scared? Does it feel good to move? Does it feel good to jump? Does it feel good to do this platforming section? Is it satisfying? Is it intimidating? Is it like, where am I at? And so, yeah, like these are, we have like core pillars, like one being our narrative structure. The other being that not all horror games have to be slow. And so us being, I mean, we all have a background in like retro FPS. We love movement. And so you have this challenge of how do you make how do you make a player able to move but also feel vulnerable, and so you have like these things stacked against each other and us trying to balance them, and yeah, so again with our title we're finding this really nice multifaceted thing that we're creating. We're trying to make something bold and unique and make design choices that are interesting, and also at the same time like doing our best to be aware of how it's going to be experienced by people. Because again, you don't want to just have, hey, here's a narratively structured game. You're going to walk through and you're going to see this stuff. Like you also need to be like, yeah, but is that fun? That stuff's fine. But is the player having fun moving? And if the answer is no, then we have failed at our goal. And so, yeah, there's a lot of stuff going on. And I think the biggest challenge with it is to like the dreaded feature creep, is to push back against that. And when you're improving one thing, what's it going to cost you in another area and all that stuff. So, yeah, we're having a great time with it. I'll tell you that.
And that's, you know, that's great to hear. And just really brief before I, you know, move on to the next question, cause you said, you know, the question or that, you know, you'd obviously have to ask internally and whatnot, how to make a horror game fun without it just focusing on the horror or, you know, the movement and everything. Have you considered crippling anxiety and abandonment issues? Because I think that would really help. I
can guarantee you there's crippling anxiety, actually. We have some pretty horrible things that take place. And then we purpose very often to reset the player emotionally. We have some systems in place that bring comfort and joy so that we can dash you to pieces with anxiety once again.
That's very interesting to hear, and I look forward to getting to experience that and checking it out when the game is, you know, when it is eventually finished and released, because like you said, you had to announce early. So, you know, there's obviously going to be some time ahead, but I look forward to it. Now, Jared, I am curious about this one, just because, you know, you stream, you're a lead on Reload Magazine, you're working on 100 Acre Woods. Obviously, you have a lot on your plate when it comes to working, and you know, with streaming, I would presume gaming as well. So I'm curious, outside of games, or you know, your games as like a job umbrella in this scenario, what do you enjoy doing? Like, how do you relax? And if it's more games, that is 100% valid. But I like to ask that in the event that it is not games.
I gave up recreation to have a life like this. And I'm very fortunate to have a job, a general daytime job that's fun. Like I've streamed for a long time now, and I have, we kind of have like a minimum amount of money that, or a specific amount of money that comes in during my daytime job that allows me to keep doing that, and to justify the time I put into that. And so I'm very fortunate in that my day job is fun, because I don't allow myself to really have fun outside of that. And that's a thing that I chose to do several years ago, because I wanted to stay married and I wanted to be a good dad. I noticed that a lot of guys who stream and get involved in games, in particular, this applies to streamers because it's exciting and it feels neat when people acknowledge you as a person and you get obsessed. There's this stream obsession that happens where guys only think about streaming and gaming and the community they're attached to. And then after they're all done with that stuff, at the end of the day, they need to relax. And so they go play more games. And I'm like, I can't do that to my wife and my kid. And now I have kids. But so I made the choice to kind of give up like recreation. And so I get up in the morning, I see my kid for about an hour, 30 minutes maybe, fix her some food, have a cup of coffee, read in the morning for just a short while, maybe 15 minutes. And then I come down to my office. I work on the game. I stream. And then afterwards, I go upstairs and I help make dinner and I hold my baby. And my kid will make me maybe play some Minecraft with her or watch a YouTube video with her. We always make sure she's seven. So if there's a YouTube video, I have to be there. And so I provide those experiences with my kids. And then at the end of the night, I generally will sit next to my wife. Maybe I'll lug my computer upstairs because I don't have a laptop, and I'll work on the game or I'll work on something for the magazine. I'll write or whatever. But then I go to sleep at the end of the night. And so I don't really allow myself to relax. And you'd think that that would have negative like health detriment. Like it doesn't really, because I'm not a heavy drinker. I'm not particularly unhealthy. So yeah, it's like the question being like, what do you do to relax? And I really don't, but I don't feel like I'm lacking in that. And I think a lot of it just is that I get to do fun stuff regularly anyway. So I don't have a lack of fun in my life. And a lot of the time people by relax, they mean, how do you have fun? And I go, well, I just kind of enjoy everything I do. And then maybe take a nap once a month. Like that works. That'll reset me just enough. But really it was like either I try to have fun and relax, which would cause me to neglect my family, or I choose to not neglect my family and then just give up my personal recreation.
So you actually raise, I think, just one first before I get started, thank you for sharing that. You know, I understand where you're coming from, and a lot of people might not, and that's fine, because, you know, part of being an adult is learning to balance all of the many things that come with adulting, mm-hmm. right? And that's not a statement against people that maybe don't have a whole bunch of adulting things on their plate. Because, you know, at some point you might, and at some point you might not, or you just never might, depending on your life. And that's perfectly fine. But thank you for sharing that. And what you said made me realize that the way that that question is phrased, I think, is really open to different interpretations, because, you know, the idea of relaxing that you raised is, you know, the confines of what people might expect relaxing is, right? And I think it's a better question of, what do you do in your downtime outside of working on games, right? Because, like, I would presume, you know, and I say this, I say this in the sense of, you know, the only people that I have spoken to or heard from that talk about spending time with their kids as not like it might not be traditionally relaxing, but as, you know, like, oh, I have to spend time with my kids as a task, as a job, as a thing uh-huh. they do and not enjoy, are usually really crappy parents or just crappy people in general, right? And from what I've gathered, you are not a crappy person. And I'm only phrasing it all this way.
No, that's totally fine.
To add to the framing of, you know, I think saying relax, the connotations that, or the interpretation that we can have of it, you know, I would very much imagine you just sitting with your 7-year-old daughter, I believe you said she was, mm-hmm. And watching some YouTube videos or watching her play Minecraft or helping with Minecraft or what have you. I imagine that would be a relaxing time for you. However, it doesn't fall into the constraints.
It is
of
not.
What,
no, oh. it is not. Oh my gosh. I think, and this is the funny thing, because you say like, you know, crappy parents and the task thing with kids. I love my kids. They're cool, man. Being a parent is the best thing ever, but holy crap, is it hard. Playing Minecraft with her is so hard. It's like, I mean, it borders on not fun. And watching YouTube videos, it borders on not fun. And it's an interesting thing, because spending time with your kids does have a very taskish thing about it. But it's a really important task. Because it shows that you value them. And there's a way you can talk about it that sounds one way, and a way you can talk about it that sounds another. Because you could be like, I have to hang out with my kids, And you're like, yes, you do. Well, why do you? Well, because I have an emotional pull that tells me, like, this is important to me, and I want to not neglect this because I want my kid to know that they are valuable and that they're special to me and that they're worth my time. And so there's this passionate pull to complete the task. And so it is a weird balance because it is definitely not. Like if I were going to list, Jared, what do you want to do to relax and what do you want to do for fun? That wouldn't make it on my list. It would not be there. But there's nothing I'd rather be doing simultaneously, if that makes sense. I grew up this is harsh. If he heard this, he'll have to interpret it. I grew up without a dad. I saw him on weekends, but he was doing his own thing and he left the family when I was young. I remember distinctly how special it felt when my dad and I would play Doom over the internet, or not even the internet at that point, where we would just play over our modems. It felt very special to me. It was a task, I'm sure. I don't think he enjoyed playing it. It wasn't a thing that he loved, but he did it anyway. And that during that time, during those moments, I felt loved. And he does love me, and that would be the moment of expression. And so I am with my family. I've not left my family. I'm not going to leave my family. But I recognize the value of those moments. And so, I want to be a good dad, and I love my kids, but I also additionally recognize that it's hard. It is so hard to be a parent because I'd love to go play Helldivers like at the end of my night. I'd love to do that. But it's really important that I sit with my kid and that she and I play Minecraft and she makes me in game watch her wash her dogs. Like, not a thing I'm super amped on, but I'll do it because I know the impact that it has on this little human.
So I'm trying to think of the best way to move forward with how I speak, because going back to the adulting thing, that, you know, that's a whole separate plate. That's parenting, right? And that's something. I don't have children. However, I understand where you're coming from. As someone that has my parents divorced when I was very young, three, who also only saw their father every other weekend. Luckily, my father was not the Chuck E. Cheese special. if you don't know what that is,
yep,
good for you. It's good that you don't know what that is. So that wasn't my father. My father was still very much trying to be involved in the ways that he could. Right. My mother, who worked multiple jobs, so I understand what you're saying. And I think, because I'm trying to, to take some of the harshness of the way you described it for people that might not have kids, especially from the last thing I said a few moments ago, the difference in what a crappy parent would be doing versus a parent that's like, well, this is beneficial to my children, that I am present in their life, that I spend time with them, that I make them feel loved, that I do things that might not exactly be at the top of your priority list. Being with your children is the top of your priority, right? It's taking all. So like the thing you're doing with them might not be the most amazing thing in your life, but the fact that you are doing a thing with them is. And the juxtaposition against a crappy parent would be the parent that complains about having to be with their kids, not that they're complaining about having to watch their child wash their 23 dogs in Minecraft, right?
Oh, like, we got more than that. I got to tell you, I think in our current world, and I'm not joking, our current world, we probably have at least 75 dogs and they all have names.
Amazing. And like, I'm not so much saying this for your benefit. I'm saying this more to the understanding of other people that, that just aren't at that point in their life, or they haven't had the same kind of life experiences to understand the difference between I don't want to play Minecraft, but I want to be with my daughter, versus the I don't want to be with my daughter parents, right?
Yeah, it's hard. It's hard because additionally, though, sometimes you do feel that way. It's weird. Like, there is, I think there's this constant pull when we're talking about issues like this, where it's like you're fighting against everybody has this drive to just be happy and selfish. It's what we are. It's what we do as humans. Like selfishness is just like an ingrained part in people that you have to shatter over the course of your life and you never really get rid of. And so having a parent or being a parent, you it doesn't shatter that part. It still exists, but you also are like you, it also forces you to reprioritize. Like having kids for me was like, it's an interesting thing because I'm not the type of person who probably would be a good dad in like a traditional sense. If you were to write down a list of what like fatherly qualities are, I probably don't have tons of them. But when you have a kid, too bad. You'd better do the things you need to do, and then eventually, like you realize like this is payoff, this is great, and I'm emotionally driven to do these things. Parenting is very, very strange, and I don't know if my experience is similar to anybody else's. It's been a joyful challenge for me though.
And you know, yeah, I can't relate to that. As I said, I don't have children, so one day maybe those words will ring to a different sense of true, but I can understand where you're coming from, especially because, you know, I don't want to say we have a similar background, but it sounds like similar enough to be able to empathetically, you know,
yeah, no, that makes sense, yeah,
to know where you're, to 100% what that is, right? But yeah, you know, I think that's still a great approach to, you know, to ultimately aim just to be present in your child's life, right?
Yeah.
Regardless of everything surrounding it, regardless of if you think you had the proper qualities. You know, I once dated a girl who said it was a very crappy a reason to have kids so you could do better than your parents. And anyone that thinks that's a contentious statement, that is not a contentious statement. You watch your parents make mistakes and you just want to do better. And yeah, you're going to make your own mistakes. And it's a self-fulfilling prophecy. It's just
a beautiful cycle.
It's different mistakes. But she was like, no, that's a very crappy way to have reason to want to have kids. And if that's why you shouldn't want to have kids, it's like, well, no, like I want kids to do better. I want anyway, there's a whole bunch of nuance to that one. So let's not get into that. As a whole, there's a whole nuance to that. Not the girl. Anyway, now Jared, I don't want to take up too much more of your time. However, before I let you go, I want to hit you up with something lighthearted, nonsensical, and a little random with a quick lightning round of just nonsensical questions.
Okay,
now, these are just quick, no judgment, random questions. You can answer them however you see fit, okay?
Okay, I'm going to try this. I'm so bad at these. Let's do it.
If you were a transformer, is there a vehicle you wouldn't transform into on principle alone?
Oh no. For context, he sent me a picture of this and it literally has his name on it. Like it's like this is some impactful, inspirational thing. Oh no. Shoot, man. You told me you were gonna have these. I didn't think they were gonna be like this. Oh no. Based on principle. Oh my gosh. I'll tell you what, this isn't a principle, but I wouldn't want to be a school bus. Keep those kids away.
Yeah, you know, thank you. And, you know, yeah, I think a lot of us can relate to not wanting to have, actually, I'm not even going to make that joke. You know, yes, thank you. Going to hit you with lightning question number two.
Okay.
What costume and ability does Kirby inherit from you?
He inherits a horrible case of the shakes from the six cups of coffee I have in the morning.
Very valid, very thankful. If Mario was a jelly bean, what flavor would he be? Would he be one of the real flavors or just one of those, you know, trick flavors?
There's a spaghetti bean, right? I can say this isn't Italian. There's a pasta bean. There's got to be a pasta bean. That sounds horrible. I'm gonna Google this. It's got to be a pasta bean somewhere. Oh, I'm going to buy one of these if they exist. We're going to have spaghetti jelly beans later.
you know, I would expect there to be like a marinara. I don't know what a noodle bean would taste like. You know, that's a really weird thing. See, this is why these are lightning questions. I don't want to discuss them because I haven't thought of the implications surrounding them.
Oh, I think they exist. I'm going to, I'll buy them.
So thank you for that. That's the lightning round. You know, that's beautiful. That's everything I wanted to fire off. Just get three of them out there, see where they go. And, you know, for anyone that's listening, I don't know how I'll handle this for editing yet. Actually, I'll keep it in because I'm talking about it. The awkward silence before, that's the, you know, as Jared said, the inspirational poster. That is a bot that I have creating them from a pull list of quotes I have entered in. Quote unquote quotes, nonsensical questions. So, yeah, you know.
They're disarming because there's this beautiful picture of a mountain.
Yeah, you know, and a man standing on top of it asking what kind of vehicle you wouldn't want to be. You're, exactly. And I, you know, I could pop these off as just a regular quote. However, this is more fun.
Oh, it's beautiful. They're great.
Now, Jared, as I said before I fired those off, I don't want to take up too much more of your time. However, if there was anything else you want to discuss, you know, a cool game, something else that you're doing, something you feel more people should just be more aware of or what have you, the floor is yours. As well, please let everyone know where they can find more information about you, which I'll also include in the episode description.
Awesome. Is there anything I want to talk about? You know, there's this thing I just want to, like you mentioned this in your questions, and I think I was looking forward to talking, just mentioning it because of my general excitement about it, right? I absolutely love like a trend that's been happening more and more over the past couple of years is the embracement of games as art, right? Like, we talk about this a lot more. And rather, I don't want to expound too much on it, but I do really want to, like, say that as a developer, I am so inspired by people who do artistic things in games. It makes me want to be involved in the industry more and encourage other people to do so. Like, games as art is huge. Making bold artistic decisions, narratively, visually, mechanically. You have games like, and I've mentioned it several times because I'm just a huge fan, but games like Alan Wake 2 is such an incredible experience to play a game and to be like, this is art, and that feeling at a core that is understood by developers. And so as people listen to this and as I interact with people, I think that's my big drive, is I love to see people make art, especially as we're getting into the age where controversial subject, AI is going to be taking, whether we like it or not, roles in game development that it, maybe it shouldn't. I am encouraged by the growth in developers as they make art out of video games, because that is a very human, beautiful thing to do. You have, like, in Alan Wake 2, you have the musical sequence and you have these things that make you feel different and in awe of somebody's boldness to make an artistic decision in a title, and I love that, man. And I, as kind of my exit from this today, I want to thank people who do that. I want to encourage people who do that, who look at a game and say and just have the drive not just to make a game, but to make something beautiful in any sense. That's huge for me, and I wanted to just kind of have that as something I'm connected with on the way out the door. If people want to get to know me, want to know who I am, I don't know. I'm kind of all over the place. I'm on Twitter, Jared R. Bear. I'm there pretty often because all my things kind of connect to that. I stream on Twitch, Jared R. Bear. I'm there most of my time. I also stream for 3D Realms. I'm over there twice a week on their Twitch and their YouTube and stuff. As we get into Realms Deep season, you'll see me more connected with that movement and project. But really, I'm just kind of all over the place. And I think what I want to say is, rather than, hey, if you find me interesting and want that, like, if you if there's anything I can do, if there's encouragement I can offer, if there's inspiration in anything that I can offer, like I am here for that. I want to see other people succeed in this industry and in life in general. And when people look at the projects I'm involved with and the attitude that has been formed over the years, kind of an attitude of service to people to improve people's lives and projects and just general enjoyment in life. Like, even if I don't know you, I want that for you. And so cross my path so I can want that for you in a more personal way.
So, you know, thank you. That is a very good high note to leave everything on. Obviously I'll keep, you know, to speak to it explicitly, you know, the Twitter, the Twitch, the what have you, all that will be in there, but you know, a very good high note to leave on the positivity of wanting to spread positivity and, you know, have someone in the cheerleading corner. I don't know if that's the appropriate
term. Yeah, that's
totally
fine, yeah.
As well as, you know, speaking to games as art and the more embracing or the more ability, weird way to say it, however, you know, that it's more prevalent that gaming can be seen and treated as art. I think that's a fantastic high note to leave things on. So Jared, thank you so much for today. And if there was nothing else, I will 100% let you get off your day.
All right. I'm going to play Helldivers. It's calling my name. I got to help freedom and democracy.
Well, you know, as long as you're doing your part.
I really hope I do.
So thanks again to Jared for making time to have this conversation with me, and thank you for joining us on the Red Tunic podcast, as well as a special thanks to Roland Jenkins for the use of music from the title track from Roadsteep. And be sure to check out the episode description for links to socials, websites, and other means that allow you to learn more about or support Jared and the podcast. And while you're doing that, share, like, follow, and whatever else you think makes the algorithm work. Thanks, until next time,